Ladies and gentlemen, please stay seated for the five-star podcast on Three Red Kings. Introducing your host, the Eggman, the cult leader of the Secret Club, and the best in the world, Tom Savage.
It's the final countdown.
You know, it's been a really weird few days. On Saturday night, I got to see Six Nations in my lifetime that Ireland have won. And like so many other people, and you know what? I should also clarify, because these people clarified in the messages and emails I've gotten since, because obviously there was a bank holiday yesterday, that I thought, you know what? I'm going to just fool around on a bank holiday Monday. So I did. And I got a chance to look at all the emails that normally come in before the Five Star Podcast, that or after the Five Star Podcast, by the time I've recorded it. So I got to have a look at them. And these people all clarified, because they felt they had to clarify, that as Leinster fans, there was a feeling of disappointment about this Six Nations, that they couldn't shake, that every time they looked online, they saw Ireland, we were rubbish in the 90s, and the 80s for a bit. Sure, we should just sit back and enjoy it. That's totally true. Sit back and enjoy. Don't bother stressing over Irish rugby when Ireland have just won the Six Nations and we're a few points away and a knock-on away from a Grand Slam. Do not stress about it. But if you're feeling not let down, but a bit like there's a party that just didn't quite kick off. You know the ones. Where everything was set up for it to be great, but it just didn't happen. You're not alone. And let me just get out of the way first, before I get into why I think people are feeling that. For Ireland to win this Six Nations, these are great times. They always say that you never realise, you know, when you're living in the good old days. And these could well be the good old days that we're living through right now. But I would also say that if you're looking at a game like this and a campaign like this and coming away feeling that a bit flat, I get that as well. One, we cannot understate, first of all, how valuable these Six Nations wins are for Irish rugby in general. The prize money that we make for winning this Six Nations is actually more, I think, than what it is to get to a semi-final of a World Cup, I think, which only happens every 4 years. So financially, it's hugely important to this Irish team and hugely important to this union, to basically the union who funds everything. It's vitally important for sponsors to keep the money flowing at the Aviva, to keep the tickets as difficult to get this season as they were for the most part. All that stuff is vitally important. And as I said, I've only seen six of these in my lifetime. People before me, maybe they only saw one. I get that as well. At the same time though, I'm not going to, and I don't think you should either, sit back and just go, everything is great, just because Ireland won. I saw somebody had a quote from Shannon Sharp there in the Discord the other day. And they were saying, you shouldn't accept things in a win that you wouldn't accept from things in a loss. And I think that kind of sums up a lot of this championship outside the first game against France, where we were objectively good, albeit with an asterisk as well. I think for the general vibe, I'll get to this particular game against Scotland in a minute. I think for the general vibe, it's good. It's certainly a lot better than if Ireland had maybe blown this game, which was 100% possible, by the way, and plausible based on how the game played out. It seemed like for a while there that it would be the perfect counterpunch game from Scotland. But I think for the most part, looking at how Ireland's championship has gone, I think the reason why you might be feeling a bit flat is it is a regression, right? Last year we won a Grand Slam, which for me was as good as any of them that Ireland have won. We were up against all of the teams who are like on their way, like, you know, France were like, that was their team for their home World Cup. So beating them in Dublin was a massive achievement. You were dealing with a Welsh team who still had a majority of their veterans there. So that's a tough game as well. We beat them out the gate. You had Scotland who were primed for a World Cup as well. England were still in a bit of a doldrum as well, but they're always a tough opponent, I think, for the most part. And that Grand Slam win, that was just below 2009 in my head anyway, and a little bit above 2018 when it comes to Grand Slams, the three that I've seen in my lifetime. So when you see that and then look at how the World Cup went, which again, there was a feeling that we kind of limped our way through that for the most part. You know, we beat South Africa, the eventual champions. They left 12 points off the tee and were held up over the line in the last minute off a mall. Then we were beaten by New Zealand. And, you know, there was a whole we lost but we won stuff that came out in the aftermath of that game. And that World Cup, which, again, as I said in this podcast, it didn't sit well with me. It kind of sat a little bit like, we've moved beyond this, you know? Where, you know, guys I respect, Keith Earls, Johnny Sexton, I almost said Johnny Zeebo there for some reason, Johnny Sexton, saying that their goal was to inspire the country. That might well be true. But what would really have inspired the country is if Ireland had got to a World Cup final and won it. So the whole we lost but we won stuff, I don't know, they kind of sat badly with me. So looking into the Six Nations as it came around, my idea was, we are primed here now. It must be a Grand Slam. France are missing Romain Antemac and Antoine Dupont for the entire tournament. England are resetting. I don't know what Wales are doing. Like, resetting doesn't even really cover it. It doesn't even cover it. Just how much of a reset Wales are doing at the moment. They are in the doldrums this season with the hope that things will improve in, you know, 2 years' time, and maybe they will, but they're in a bad place right now. Italy are 100% improved, but coming from a low base, to the point where they should have beaten a heartless France, heartless in that they've had the heart kicked out of them by Antoine Dupont and Romain Antemac not being available to them. They are such a reduced team without those two guys in it. As I said before, the thing that everybody assumed would happen to Ireland without Sexton happened to France without Dupont. But that's beside the point. Scotland probably were the most settled team coming into this. Like, England, for example, were still bedding in core parts of their game plan in week three of this Six Nations. So, look, it was our Grand Slam to win. We were the most settled team in the tournament, albeit with, on the face of it, on paper, the most change in that Ireland have had Johnny Sexton at 10 since 2012. They're making a change and bringing in this guy who did not have the extended bedding in period that Joey Carberry had. This is his first Six Nations as a guy who's even going to be in the match day 23 regularly. If you remember last season, it was Ross Byrne. So there was obviously big question marks over that. As it turned out, those question marks were unfounded. So Ireland, I won't say sleepwalked to a Six Nations title, but once we beat France after, you know, France went down to 14 men, and then beat Italy, sloppy enough performance, but we won fairly handily there as well. beat Wales, who were so one-dimensional in that game. They were gutsy in defence, had nothing in attack. A little bit like Scotland, actually. And then lost to England. That was the kicker for a lot of people. Like, even last week, I have people who get on to me who are just like, if you hear about any tickets for the Aviva, if you hear about any tickets, let me know. Let me know. They weren't there last week. No, it's not like the Aviva is stuck for people to go in there and buy tickets for it. It's impossible. But it felt like the interest and the buzz kind of fell back a little bit. And Ireland ended up winning. And it was a little bit underwhelming, the performance in general. But I think that's what people are feeling. They're feeling that it's a bit of a regression from 2023. That is the issue. That there's a feeling that we didn't quite manage to win this Six Nations as emphatically as our stability coming into the tournament suggested that we should. Ireland are the ultimate cohesion team. It is Ireland or FC. If you listen to the way that the players there speak about each other, the way that Andy Farrell speaks about the players, the level of cohesion there, and I've been on and on about cohesion, but like the level of understanding and the relationship between these senior players is like what you would see at a club. And that's been deliberately fostered over the last couple of years. That has good sides and it has downsides. And that is like so hard to beat if you're the likes of France or England or whatever else. If you're coming in experimenting or even half experimenting, it's so difficult to beat a team who plays like that to the level that Ireland do. And even then, with that, I thought Ireland looked tired against England and they looked tired here against Scotland. They still won. Elements of controversy about the decisive Andrew Porter try, who's up there with the player of the tournament for me from an Irish perspective. But that's neither here nor there. Ireland won it out in the end. But I got a bad feeling watching that game against Scotland that they have us mostly worked out here and we look tired and we look slow and old, which is a big concern. But look, to get into the game against Scotland. First of all, part of the reason why I think Ireland were looking so tired against Scotland was because there was nearly 41 minutes of ball in play in this game, which would be the second highest we've played in the tournament so far this season. Part of that reason was, I think we wanted to bring Scotland into that place physically. We've done that quite a bit against them actually, where we bully them with our fitness and look to try to run them over that way. Didn't work here, not in the same way that it has previously. So that was a factor in the game. From a kick perspective, they kicked more or less the same as ourselves. Well, exactly the same. They had 30 kicks. We had 30. They kicked for 922 meters. We kicked for 693. We pulled our kicking back a little bit, which we would expect. We would expect in a situation like this, but we certainly did that. It did that. But again, our breakdown of how many long kicks we did and how many short tactical kicks we did was almost identical. It's like Ireland and Scotland mirrored each other in some ways, which I think goes some way to explain why it was such a deadlocked game for so long. I mean, this was 7 points to six at halftime. There was a period there where Ireland were 4 points up and could have like easily a bad bounce of a ball and Scotland had that game won. So part of that is because of, one, how closely our attacking profiles looked on the day. Like, again, we carried way more than they did. We passed the ball, obviously, way more than they did because that's just what Ireland do. 216 passes to 131 for Scotland. We had 16 handling errors, which, again, played a part in why this looks so difficult. We had 18 turnovers conceded as well on top of that, which, again, that all plays into why this game looked the way it looked and felt the way it felt. But I think that, in the end, Ireland did deserve the win and the championship as a result. But looking at how the pass per carry thing broke down, Ireland were around 1.4, which, again, that's good. Like, as in, that's in and around the ballpark for what we've seen for this team. A little bit lower than what we've seen in general, though. And when we look at our kick-to-pass ratio, it was back up in the on-ball range of around 7, well, it was exactly 7.4, which was still lower than what we did against Italy and against Wales, but that gave us a tournament average of 7.1, which is decisively more than, you know, the nearest one would be Wales at 6.1. So when we look at how we played away from home and at home, there is quite a bit of a difference. But I think that's deliberately rated to how dangerous the opposition we felt was at the time as well. Like, away against France, for example, we had a kick or a pass to kick ratio of 5 passes per kick in round 1 against France, which is our lowest of the tournament. No, actually, no, it's our second lowest of the tournament, and would be in line with the likes of what England do, for example, in and around what England play. In our second round against Italy, it was 9.7 passes per carry in that on-ball range. Against Wales, it was 10.1. We didn't rate these two teams. We were right to do so against Wales, and if Italy had been a little bit more switched on, we would have gotten a little bit of a counterpunch against them as well, I feel. But in round 4 in Twickenham, we had a pass-to-kick ratio of 4.2, our lowest of the tournament, playing off-ball rugby essentially, or close enough to it. Very, very low counter-transition rugby, and we're back up to 7.4 this weekend against against Scotland, which again is lower than what we expected. I think we had a lot of respect for Scotland in this game. We felt that, and I think our kick volume per ruck, it was around what, 4 kicks per ruck, which will just give you an idea as well of, you know, how much more we of the ball we had and how much more expansive we were happy to play than what we were against England, but well below what we were doing against Wales and Italy, because I think we really feared or were wary of what Scotland could do to us at the breakdown. And we were right to do so, because if you look at the breakdown, 53% of our rucks were under 3 seconds, which is lower than what it would normally be. We lost 3 rucks in this game. You look at our the percentage of our rucks that were between 4 and 6 seconds, it was 31.45%. Scotland did a really good job of slowing us down there in a way that other teams haven't. They tackled all day long as well defensively. They were really, really good. But I did think it was interesting that when we look at how Ireland lose games, right? There are 2 factors. Ireland's breakdown being well below 90%. That didn't happen here. And our lineout being dragged below 85%. It was close, though, in this game, right? Like, against... it's gone to the dogs. Gone to the dogs is a bit much. In the first 2 games against France and Italy, it was 100% completion, right? And again, we have a very conservative lineout now, right? In a way where, like, so much of our lineout work is to the front and to the front of the middle, like, and so little is to the tail and to the back. Like, we have the lowest number outside of England, actually, of attempted long throws, and we have middle of the road when it comes to our success in throwing to the back of the lineout is the worst in the Six Nations. But if you look at the 3 rounds to finish the tournament, 79% against Wales, which again explains why things looked quite janky against Wales for a time. 77% against England, well below the 85% threshold. In this game against Scotland, it was 87%, which is near enough to it. But we got choked up in the maul a few times by Scotland. We didn't complete our mauling in this game was actually fairly poor. And that all plays into what you saw in this game, which was things not looking great overall. Like, for example, like Ireland, we have 60% of our lineouts are thrown to the front. That's the second highest percentage of throws to the front. And remember, we had 68 lineouts total, which is a lot, right? France had 69, England had 68 as well. But our play style, as it transpired, leads to a lot of lineouts one way or the other. Scotland only had 54, for example. So if you look at Ireland, 41 of those 68 lineouts went to the front, 60%. France were the highest at 62% of their throws went to the front. And then 28% went to the middle, which again, like Scotland, Wales, England are way more, like we're fourth. Italy do 24%, and France did 25%. But again, you look at Italy, part of the reason why they're so much better this season is they've gotten rid of all the things that used to mess them up. And part of that was their lineout being a little bit overly ambitious. They completely tailed that back. But when it comes to the back of the lineout, we are in, again, just like Scotland have thrown 11 to the back. France 9, we're tied with England. So like we are quite conservative in the lineout, for example. Like we're 100% when it comes to the first couple of games, as I said. But when you look at the overall tone of the lineout, I felt that a little bit disappointing. Especially how it finished. It wasn't the sort of massive attacking platform that I think it usually is and could be. Which again, I think if you're feeling that we kind of tapered off a small bit towards the end of the Six Nations, that's part of the reason as well. So yeah, look, I just think that as you go back and watch this game, and looking at the territory, for example, Ireland had the majority of the territory, as you would expect. But I think for Scotland and for Ireland, they'll be looking at what they saw from us in this game. And I think that they'll be very, very interested that their scouting of Ireland's attack actually worked really well. Like 48% of our possession was in, and remember we had from a possession perspective, we had 59% of the ball, which is a lot in this game. 48% of it and 31% of our possessions was in their half of the field. 48% between the halfway line and the 22. 31% of the ball in that 22. Scotland had 51% in the between halfway and our 22 of their limited possession. But that's kind of the kicker, really. Like, we just look at some of our 22 entries for here and just look at some of the efficiency. Like, Scotland were way more efficient. They had 2.5 points on 4 entries. We had 1.7 on 10. And you can look at, well, why is that? Why is that? And I think part of the reason is we're not getting over the gain line. We're not impacting teams physically with the ball in hand. A lot of our work, and this goes into our high pass per carry count as well. And actually, I think the fact that we had a lower, normally it's around 1.7, 1.8. I think we have a lower pass per carry ratio here because we try to play more direct. We tried to truck it up through the middle on Scotland because I felt that we felt we had a decisive advantage there physically. But it didn't really transpire that way either. Our pass quality wasn't great throughout. And again, that's not a massive criticism of Jemison Gibson-Park. His game is what it is. And he doesn't need to be the most accurate passer. Because again, he passes with such speed. And he has so many other qualities to his game. It actually doesn't really matter. But just look, breaking it down, some of the bits and pieces I saw during the game. Like, we didn't have the sort of... I don't know. Like, you look at... Our ruck completion rate was 98%, right? Which is, again, it's grand. But if you look at our collision work, I'm not sure that we were as good there as what we needed to. Again, like you look at our carries, Andrew Porter was our top ball carrier. Now again, he's a platform ball carrier, tough fucking man to stop as well, but he's not an explosive ball carrier at this stage. This is that game where I was hoping that we would see an awful lot of Joe McCarthy getting on ball and imposing himself. But it just didn't happen. And again, I think that what his role is right now is kind of... Obviously, he's that tight head lock in that power forward build. but he's not a tight head lock power forward. Like, his breakdown work has kind of improved over the Six Nations. He's not massively efficient there. That will come with time, obviously. He's still very raw in that regard. His dominant cleanouts are very good when he lands them. But again, I felt that I was waiting for Joe McCarthy to start imposing himself physically. Because I think looking at this Irish team, all very skilled, loads of good handlers of the ball. But if you go through that pack, right, you have your front row. Furlong is not a guy I want to see carrying the ball all that often anymore. Andrew Porter carried the ball a lot here. Typically, he doesn't really do that, but he did that in this game because I felt, and I think he felt, that we needed that guy. Dan Sheehan is not an edge forward in the traditional sense, in that he will carry exclusively separated from the rest of the pack in that, you know, 15-meter channel, because Ireland's forwards stay really narrow to each other now. The formation that we play in the forwards looks to me to be like almost like a 4-2-X, because that edge forward isn't really an edge forward anymore. It's all about ball retention. And like, Dan Sheehan has been really good this year. Like, his line-out throwing has been really good, bar one game. But he's not the sort of, oh, throw the ball out to the edges and he's going to run over guys there for fun. We didn't play that way. So I think looking at how he played it in this particular game, just a lot of physicality, which is what we want. Like, again, like, Dan Sheehan brings, he's like another number eight. And he does that from the number, you know, from wearing the hooker jersey. So we don't want those guys carrying all that much, really. Our back five, if you go through it, has a lot of kind of support forwards, really. Like, you have Tadhg Byrne, who can carry the ball a lot, but he's not a guy who's a hugely impactful ball carrier. He will chuck the ball up in the middle of the field, recycle it really well most of the time. He's really good offensive break. Like, again, it's that swing lock role set. Then you've got Caelan Doris, who I think the more he ends up carrying the ball in the game, and bear in mind as well, he carries quite a bit on transition, right? He's not a guy who I think you want to be loading up for 15, 16 carries a day or a game off nine. I don't think that's his game. It's the sort of game that is tailor-made for Joe McCarthy, though, right? Like, you would think so. 120 kg, 6'6", let him truck the ball up off nine. And I keep hearing that that's what he did in this tournament, but he didn't really. Like, he didn't really do that. He didn't do it against England. He didn't have a massive game against Scotland either when it comes to imposing his physicality around the place. And again, I think that he's been videoed up quite a bit by the opposition analysts, and they have targeted him as such. They see him as a guy who, rightly, because it's true, gives Ireland energy when he gets that go-forward ball, so they've made a point to ensure that that doesn't happen. So this happens to every young player who has a big breakthrough. You have to give him the respect of videoing him and then seeing if he can respond to that. So that's Joe McCarthy's turn next. I think that the next couple of weeks and months in for Leinster will play a big part, as well as James Ryan seems to be out. So Joe McCarthy will have to lead a lot of things defensively and offensively that at the moment I don't think he's ready for. But we will see how it goes. Good tournament overall, though. I would say that he's a fella who we will need in prime form and performing the role that he should be by South Africa, because that is going to be an incredibly big physical challenge down there. And in some teams, they look at, you know, they'll take out the 10 and they'll do this, that and the other, because from a physical perspective, everybody is kind of like the same. South Africa will be taking in everything that they've heard about big Joe McCarthy and looking to try to see just how big he is. These are the challenges that come in this game. Paul O'Connell had to go through the same. Donegal O'Callaghan, James Ryan even had to go through these proving. Ian Henderson had to go through these proving grounds. That will be a big proving ground down at the Highveld, playing the Springboks. So overall, good tournament from him. And again, need guys of that profile, need guys with that physicality. The more those guys we have fit and available and playing for Ireland, I think the better that we'll be. Because as I said before, again and again, the important thing here is winning and continuing to win. So in that regards, this Six Nations win is exactly what we needed. I'm addressing why people maybe felt a little bit disappointed, because it wasn't a slam. And the feeling was that we limped over the line in the end against one of the weakest Six Nations that we've seen in a while, quality-wise, even though some of the games were really exciting. I don't think you could say that France were their usual selves, or that England were what we traditionally associated with them, and that Wales are in not a great place. Not a great place at all. But anyway, so that's kind of what my feelings on it were. And again, you think some of the feelings that are like that that you might have in the game, I think they're related very much to that. But looking at the actual teams themselves, my initial ratings at the moment are everybody's kind of starting off at 3. I've Andrew Porter rated quite highly here. I thought he had a really good game against Xander Fagerson. I've had a few emails about, oh, you think Andrew Porter scrummaging is good. Now, with that link to that gif of Ireland destroying Scotland in the scrum. As I said before the game, Scotland's scrum is not what it was. But even then, if we look at the profile that I've said of the type of guys who give Andrew Porter a whole ton of trouble. Super heavyweight tight heads. Is that Xander Fagerson? It is not. It is not. Is he a guy who is going to physically dominate Andrew Porter strength-wise? Absolutely not. And he didn't, so it didn't matter. He is not able to hold Andrew Porter and then start to use that turn that Andrew Porter does. To be fair, every loose head does, more or less, they're looking for an angle. He cannot punish him there. So he can't attack how reliant Andrew Porter is on that outside shoulder in a way that shows that he was a tight head prop initially when he broke through at pro level. You can't take advantage of that. You can't take advantage of elbow down because you don't have the size, don't have the power. Xander Fagerson is not that guy. Andrew Porter ate him up really for the majority. By the way, Xander Fagerson and Pierre Schumann actually tackle each other into the ground, by the way. Not each other. They tackled Ireland into the ground. They had huge work rate. But in the scrum, they had very little for Ireland. Tig Furlong, another really good game from him. Really good as well to see him lifting the trophy at the end. That was a nice touch. That was really emotional. I felt that. Especially the bit at the end where Peter Manny's obviously talking to Tig Furlong, who's quite emotional as well. That was great to see. I love that shit. Because I remember... This is something that bothered me as well over the weekend, where there were people who were going on about, oh, Peter O'Mahony crying during the anthem. And it was Ireland's call, whatever it was. It's just shitty people, do you know? Like, they were just like, oh, he's crying over Ireland's call. As in, this is some, you know, like he's some fella out of fucking Trinity moved by fucking Phil Coulter. Nah. Look, I remember seeing Tig Furlong crying during the Italy game. It was the first game that he would have played for Ireland in the Aviva since his father passed away. And where he would have been sitting, probably looking up into the stand where his father would have been. So of course you're going to be emotional. And like, guys find emotional at all different times. Like, I've spoken to fellas who've stood for Aran Devine and who've stood for Ireland's call. And sometimes the emotion that you get during Aran Devine, you throw into singing it and getting that energy. But Ireland is quite unique in that we have two anthems. We have three, really. You have the presidential march at home, then you have Aran Devine, and then you have Ireland's call. And like, Ireland's call is actually important, I think, because we can't get trapped into this idea that Ireland, the Irish rugby team, is, you know, the Republic of Ireland, or the Irish Republic, or whatever you want to call it, and excludes Northern Ireland. This is an all-island team. So the idea that, oh, well, you'll come down here, you'll play for us, you'll wear the green jersey, we're going to play our own event, and that's it. Not your anthem, not even the country that you identify with, but you'll have to fucking stand there, and that's all we'll do. I think having Ireland's call there is a good compromise. Because there's some guys there, they'd be happy enough with God Save the King. And that's fine too. I think that we have an island here where if we want to do things together in the future and be one island in the future. The idea that it's only ever going to be what we want and the exact way that, we had it down here, where, oh, it'll just be a 32-county country, and it'll just be Aran na Bhean, and it'll just be the tricolour, and that'll be that, and you'll just have to like it. I don't think it's fair, I don't think it's right, I don't think it's realistic. So the idea that you have Ireland's Call, it just gives something else. It's saying that, look, we are not just Ireland down here. We're not just the, you know, it's excluding the six counties above. It's not that. We want them to feel included. And if that means singing Ireland's Call, which again, look, I started off being against it, but I quite like it now. I don't sing it. But my point is that for the fellas who do sing Aran na Bhean and feel it, and that fucking pride of playing for your country in Dublin in front of your home crowd, sometimes it only really hits you on the second anthem, which, again, we have, other teams don't have. So that emotion can kind of come out then, because Ireland's Call is kind of seen as being a bit of a release where, well, Ireland's Call is on now, so you feel the emotion of what's just happened. Typically, you'd be walking over to get ready for the kickoff, but you have to stand there for Ireland's Call. So that's kind of like the some of the guff I saw thrown at Peter O'Mahony. It's just not realistic. These people don't exist in real life. And again, the rumours were that it was Peter O'Mahony's last game for Ireland in Dublin. Now, whether that means that he will go on the summer tour, I don't know. But those rumours were around an awful lot. I mean, you see those tears, you know, after the Aran na Bhean. That does suggest that there's something going on there, because he was asked directly about it and kind of, you know, fudged the question a small bit. But I felt he had a really good game, and you could tell that he was going to have a good game, and he did. Individually, I thought he hit a lot of the stuff that we associate with Peter O'Mahony all the way through. So yeah, I enjoyed that. And this is the thing as well. I'll mention as I'm going to say it now, because I've said it before, so I'll say it here. This Irish team is getting old, right? Tadhg Furlong, Tadhg Byrne, Peter O'Mahony, Josh van der Fleer. Josh is heading into, he's going to be hitting 30 soon. Gibson Park, 32. James Lowe, 31, 32. Bundy Aki, 33. Robbie Henshaw hitting his 30s as well. And then on the bench, Keane Healy, 48 years of age. Finlay Whelan is 33, I think. Jack Conan, 31, 32. Conor Murray, 35. Gary Ringrose, heading into his 30s as well. We're an old enough team. Like, realistically speaking, we are, right? So there's a reset coming. And, like, for Peter O'Mahony, if this is his last game for Ireland, I'm delighted that he went out in Dublin lifting that Six Nations trophy. Perfect. A perfect end for a guy who's had a fucking legendary career. Like, Munster captain, Ireland captain, Lions test captain. Not very many fellas in this country can say that. Out of all the fellas who've played. You're looking at Paul O'Connell, another fella who's done that. And one other fella as well, whose name escapes me. But with that sort of experience, those sort of achievements, he's been my litmus test of, do you know ball, right? Because if I see somebody who's determined that Peter O'Mahony does nothing in teams, straight away, this guy does not know ball. There's a reason why every single coach he's worked under has not only made him a starter, but has usually made him a captain. It's because of the stuff that he does that is vital to the running of a team on field. This is not being a good leader. This is not being a guy who sets a big emotional tone. He does all those. It's the quality of his breakdown work, his skill set as a player as well, and his importance, I think, and his emergence for Ireland in 2010, you know, from in the 2010s, I would say, up until today. The reason why he's had such a really, really long career is because his super strength as a player was the line-out. This game was dominated by the line-out from in the 2010s up until now. So all of that role set he gives you, along with his defensive breakdown stuff, the emotional tone he sets, the big games he's had for Ireland in particular, that's a legendary career. And if it is the end for him in Ireland, 105 caps as a flanker in this game, in the modern age, some player. absolute, and again, a legend of Irish rugby. And for me, stacks up in any all-time Irish rugby team. Like, and again, you look at the respect he's held in by people from all over the world. The respect that they hold for him, or the hate they have for him. You know, I mean, that kind of weird kind of rugby hate. That'll show you. Because sometimes I think it's your enemies that show you how good you are rather than your friends, if that makes sense. And he's got a lot of enemies, and that's because he's very, very good. But my point is that we are going to need a bit of a refresh of this team because, one, they have a ton of miles on the belt. On the belt? On the clock. Miles on the belt. Because like Andrew Porter, for example, still a relatively young man. James Ryan's around the same, 27, 28, there or thereabouts. I could easily Google this. But has so much rugby. And again, we're not talking about like 28 years of age, right? There's a lot of rugby under the belt for him. And it's hard, heavy test rugby. And so many minutes. That's going to be a big factor in like, when do these guys have drop-offs, right? Because that comes with age and it comes with miles on the clock. And that would be my concern, is that as we're heading now into next, we'll say next Six Nations 2025, is that Ireland's opportunity to reset? Because it's like, it's not like that any of these fellas are bad players. Again, because the minute I start talking about, well, we need to start looking at replacing guys, straight away they're going, well, who do you drop? And this is the point. You don't leave replacing guys until they're literally unable to go anymore. Okay? So if you have, like, Tadhg Byrne, for example, I'll just stick to Munster players. If you have Tadhg Byrne and Peter Omani, like, Tadhg Byrne is, he's got a lot of miles in the clock as well for him. Like, as in, he's, like, since he's come back to Ireland in the last 6 years, like, he's 32 now. He'll be 33 in the next Six Nations, coming to the end of his central contract, actually, at that stage. Again, that's heading to the time when guys will typically start to see it physically, they'll start dropping off a small bit. Guys age, and age is undefeated in this game, except maybe by Cian Healy. He is still 37-0 against age, really. It's actually remarkable he's still going, and he's actually going to keep going again next year in such an attritional position. But even then, you'll see he's not the guy that he was either. My worry is that, like, looking at the Scottish team, and again, in the Wally ratings, you'll see what I think they've made of our defence, because it's easier to describe with, or our attack rather. It's easier for me to describe that with graphics. But I think looking at the overall age of the team, that's something I think we'll have to look at going forward, and we can't leave it to, oh, we'll be grand. We'll do it at some point. Who are you going to drop? That's the thing. We need to be able to rotate guys in and have it not framed as guys getting dropped. Because, like, you look at who's going to be the core of this team, right? Who's the core of this team going forward? Calvin Nash had a great tournament. A really good tournament. Played 5 games for Ireland and looked really good, really well balanced. Looking in great shape too, actually. James Lowe is 31. He's going to be 32 soon, I think. So, how long more is he going to be active? Again, we can't go in to this World Cup, or we can't even go in. He'll be 32 this year. He'll be 32 down in South Africa, actually. So, this is where guys start to drop off a bit. We can't be left holding the bag when that happens. Right? Bundy, he's got another year going. He's probably still our best player, but how long will that be the case? We need to start looking at younger options in midfield. We need to start looking at younger options for in that James Lowe role. Jack Crowley, for the moment, looks to be fairly well settled in that 10 jersey. Obviously, he has growth to do. I'll speak a bit about him in a minute. He has a bit of growth to do for sure, but I think they're fairly happy with him there right now. I'd say fairly happy is a bit of an understatement, actually. I think they are happy with him. Jameson Gibson-Park, he's 32. He'll be 33 next year, I think. Did he turn 32 already this year? Yeah, he did. He's turned 32 in February. But again, how long more does he have in the tank? Conor Murray is 35. rumour is he's sticking over another season. Why are our top... We have three scrum halves in that squad. Why are two of them heading into their mid-30s now? Craig Casey is there. I felt he should have played a lot more in this tournament. Again, that plays part of this team being very experienced, being very tight, have a lot of cohesion, but the age is creeping up. And my worry is that the age will catch up with you all of a sudden, especially if you have a ton of miles on the clock. Like, these guys have played a lot of test rugby. Like, you've Josh van der Fleer, who's coming up on 30 as well. Caelan Doris is going to be a key guy going forward, 2027 and beyond maybe, with a bit of luck with injury. Like I said, Tyke Byrne, Joe McCarthy will as well. Dan Sheehan is there too. He's going to be a fellow who, with a bit of longevity, you would say. But that's the ultimate question, really. Like, when do we start the experimentation and the result fluctuation that will come with that to see where this team is going? We're probably not going to see that in South Africa. And we're probably not going to see it in November either, really. Although we'll see guys getting opportunities to do that against probably Argentina, maybe Fiji. But I think that depends on results elsewhere as well. I think Ireland in some ways have been lucky enough that Jack Crowley has kind of just... He emerged really at the exact right time. They tried with Frawley. They tried with a bunch of other guys to make it work. But I think that Crowley has nailed that down for the time being. But there's so many spots that it looks like where, like, loose head... tight head seems okay, but like, you've got two guys there who were starting on Saturday who are kind of heading into their early to mid-30s now. So like, Jaeger seems like a guy who can fit in there too, but my worry is that I've seen this before at Munster where we had a bunch of guys who were heading into their early 30s and mid-30s and thinking, well, look, we'll do our diligence when it comes to their S&C. We'll make sure that they're well-rested and they'll be able to keep going for another 3-4 years. Oh, it turns out they've all retired inside 2 years. And like, that happened with John Hayes. It happened with Jerry Flannery. It happened to Dennis Leamy. It happened to a bunch of guys. Ronan O'Gara, who kept going as long as they could. Politics is one bad injury and guys aren't the same. And like, you even see guys now like James Ryan, who are like, he's been on the go and playing a lot of test rugby for the last... Well, since 2017, 2018, right? So that's a good number of years now. my maths and my counting ability on the fly failing me there. But he's got a lot of rugby on the clock. And that shortens careers. Like, look at CJ Stander. Kept going until he literally couldn't keep going anymore because he was playing probably the most physically abrasive position on the field outside of scrummaging as a tight head prop. Or as the modern day lock, by the way, which is just as abrasive for guys who carry the ball a lot. Your succession plans, sometimes fate has a way of messing around with them. And I'd like to see Ireland deviate a little bit from the club Ireland that we know, that you can name off by heart. Try a few more options in there, because it seems that guys get a few limited opportunities to come in and play a role twin of a system function that's already there. And if they don't do it immediately to the high standard, they're out. Which sounds great if you're trying to, you know, give across, we have high standards. This is a high demand environment here. But it feels that it's kind of sometimes harder to get out of that club than what it is to get into it, which shouldn't be the case. And that injuries have probably been the thing that's, like Calvin Nash, for example, had a great Six Nations. I'd say came out as probably the breakout star of the Six Nations from an Irish perspective, but given that he had so little experience before. But realistically, if Jimmy O'Brien and Mac Hansen hadn't been injured, he probably wouldn't be there. Because that's just how Ireland have worked, typically. So that's a factor. And again, I think that if you can use the Six Nations that we have in the bank right now, and go, well, look, we can still go for 3 in a row next year. But we can do it while also freshening up that roster, which I do think needs to happen. Because we saw it here at the end of the Six Nations, how tired Ireland looked, even after the break. It's the same guys playing the same minutes. And you've added in guys like Ryan Baird on a 6-2 bench. That's fine. Need to see more of Ryan Baird, though. Like I said before this tournament, I'd like to see Ryan Baird taking more of Peter Omani's minutes at six, if they want to go down that route. Go with it. Go with it. Yeah, Peter Omani's the captain. Great. He had his Six Nations. Great. Go and start investing in Ryan Baird now, and Tom O'Hearn, and guys like that. And start to... It doesn't mean that you're dropping Peter Omani, or that anybody who's there is just rotated out of the team because they're looking at different options. This has been a very successful Irish team for the most part. With that success now in the bank, how brave will we be to make that switch to go, let's try out some new options? Do you know what? In the summer, Conor Murray, you can stay at home. We're going to go with Gibson Park and Craig Casey and somebody else. Maybe it's Fintan Gunn, whoever the fuck it is. I don't know. Go with somebody like that, where you have guys in a depth chart who are 30-odd. At test level in particular, it's vitally important that you make that change early, before you're forced. Because what you don't want to be in is in a situation where guys are getting thrown in last minute. We had to make that work with Johnny Sexton, by the way. Because if things that were outside of Farrell's control, to be fair. Carberry was injured for most of the year. There was nobody else there. He tried to get Kieran Frawley. Those minutes, he kept getting injured. Jack Crowley turned out, it worked out. That should not be assumed that is always going to be the case. Jack Crowley, by the way, quick word on him. Came in the toughest spot, I think, that any player came into in this tournament, to replace Johnny Sexton in that Irish 10 jersey. Again, there's only been, in the modern era, you had Humphreys and O'Gara, and they intersected with each other for 2 or 3 years. You had O'Gara and Sexton, they intersected with each other for around 2 or 3 years. And then you had Sexton, and you had a number of guys who were kind of lined up all the way along to be his successor, because Sexton started relatively late. I think he was a proper test level fly half at 27, 28. But, you know, like, that sounds, that's a bit, as in, you're damning Johnny Sexton. Like, I think that he was only a proper level 10 at that age. Because again, he played till he was 38, remember? So, like, if you take 10 years from 2023, you know, you're back to that time when he was, you know, 2014, 2015, like, that was his peak. 2012, 2013, that's when Johnny Sexton hit that elite level, in my opinion. And sometimes it takes that long. But all the way along, Ireland tried to get somebody else in there to kind of be the apprentice. They started with Paddy Jackson. He fucked it up for himself. You're looking at Joey Carberry. He was the next guy. Kind of came along out of nowhere one summer. And all of a sudden, he's the guy now. Made the move to Munster. Set up where he'll be playing regularly now. So he won't just be a backup to Johnny at Leinster and Ireland. He's going to be playing and competing against him. So he'll be ready to take over that. He gets injured. And he plays, what? Since he got that injury at the World Cup, or before the World Cup, he just fell out of the performance levels he had before. And look, that happens. Guys get hurt, guys get injured, and then they don't come back the same. Or they don't come back at the same level that they were at consistently. And that's just reality of the game. So then you look at, well, okay, then they're starting to get desperate. Is it Ross Byrne? Is it Kieran Frawley? Is it Harry Byrne? All of this was coming around from around 2020 on. Until eventually it turned out it's Jack Crowley. And to come in as he did for his first Six Nations and start every single game. Now, bear in mind, he had been in full on just like apprentice mode. Like, he had very little rugby last year in the Six Nations. Won a URC with Munster. Went to the World Cup camp. And there were people thinking, will he even make the World Cup? He goes in there as the number two after Ross Byrne was given every chance, but just, I don't think is a test level 10 consistently. If I wanted a fellow who could come in, I'd be almost sure he'd make a kick at goal. Yeah, great. But everything else, which, bear in mind, everything else is actually way more important than being, you know, super accurate off the tee. Ideally, you would have both. But this is the thing I've seen thrown at Jack Crowley. Oh, the goal kicking. Matt Williams on again at the weekend saying, oh, if he can't kick over 80% of whatever it is, he shouldn't go to South Africa. Bear in mind, the 75% that he had today in that game against England was that there were four kicks and he missed one of them. Right? The hardest one. Now, bear in mind, like, the kick he made from England from roughly the same spot was the fourth longest range kick of the tournament so far. This kick was more or less in the same area, and he got his angles wrong. So the 75% you hear Matt Williams talking about is he made 3 out of 4 kicks, right? So look, it's bullshit, because Johnny Sexton was not a fucking rock solid kicker. I would say all the way through his career, he would fluctuate up and down, as all kickers do. But again, you have that aspect of it. He's growing as a player. Even in this game, I have him rated around 3 stars at the moment. Because we struggled up front. Scotland did a really good job of shutting down our screens and shutting down our passing lanes in a way that showed they learned very much about what England had shown them the week before. But with Crowley, you can tell he's a fella who learns and who is very rigorous with the way that he watches his own work when playing, but also when training. I was talking to Tom Ahern at a press conference a few weeks ago, and he said that he lives with Jack Crowley and a few other guys at Munster. And when they come home in the evening, right, after a day of work or training, they watch back training. They watch back their training from the day to get a read on where they were good and where they weren't. So Jack Crowley is prepared. Jack Crowley understands the game. Jack Crowley understands his role in that game. So good performance from him overall. And like I said, a very difficult spot for him to be in, coming in to replace Johnny Sexton, and to come in and do it so flawlessly in a way where fellas were trying to fucking drum up problems. That's how you know he played well, and that's how you know the transition was almost seamless, because fellas were trying to invent problems. But yeah, I think that we can't rely on everybody coming in and being like Jack Crowley, especially in the front row. There's a problem brewing there. And again, I feel that this is where maybe Andy Farrell not being involved in the next year or so will be really good. He's incredibly loyal. Whoever is taking over for Ireland post-July has the opportunity to not be loyal. He has the opportunity to come in and, if there is result fluctuation, to take it on the chin himself. It's the mid-year of the cycle. I still think, as good as winning Six Nations is, the World Cup, getting to a final and winning it, has to be the next check mark for Ireland. Winning Six Nations is fine, and we should do those once every 2 years, at the very least, right? We have the talent available to do so. I think the next step to take Ireland up to the next level is that World Cup. And at the moment, this team won't get us there. Core members of this team won't get us there. Yeah, sure, there might still be valuable veteran presences at the World Cup in 2027. And I know it's 3 years away, but 3 years goes mighty quick. This last year went mighty quick on me. 3 years goes quick. So we have a bit of a reset to do that wasn't the case in post-2019. We have, and again, we did well there, because again, you had Caelan Doris coming in, you had Ronan Kelleher, and then Dan Sheehan. And then Andrew Porter being, you know, he was kind of established before that. But we kind of didn't have to make any wild changes. Lowe and Gibson Park came in straight away after the World Cup in 2019. So straight away we had, well, these guys were bubbling away in the background as senior players. That's not the case this time. Project players are gone. So this is a tricky period coming up. And there's an opportunity for whoever is replacing Farrell to take a lot of the lumps on that before Farrell comes back into fellas who have those minutes and they have those experiences in the bank. Sometimes you can't bake those in training. Sometimes you can't bake those in with camp appearances. Sometimes you can't even bake them in at Leinster. But the idea being that, well, we'll hope it'll work up at Ireland level as well. I think that there's a bit of fluctuation coming with this Irish team, but that we have to embrace that and to take that and see where we are in 2026. Because that's when this team, 2026, we should start to see core new parts of this team already embedded and see where we're at. So thank you very much for joining me in this podcast. I'll have a TRK mailbag out and all your questions on Wednesday. The presser today for Munster versus the Ospreys will be on at 3 o'clock today. That'll be out this evening. Thank you very much for joining. The Wally ratings will be out this afternoon as well, by the way. Thank you very much for joining me. I'll talk to you again very, very soon.